This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Bill Goodman joins us to talk about a lawsuit related to the water crisis in Flint, Michigan.
The undemocratically appointed leaders of the state of Michigan and the city of Flint knowingly allowed a generation of children to be poisoned by lead.
We remember the late progressive attorney Michael Kennedy and speak with former SDS leader Bernadine Dorn.
The poet's words strike us hard. There's not a joy the world can give like that it takes away.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Catherine Franke. I'm a law professor at Columbia Law School, and I chair the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, this week we've lost two longtime people's attorneys. First, Michael Kennedy, and we talk about that with Bernadine Dorn, who knew him for decades. More recently, Myron Beldock, who represented former boxer Reuben Hurricane Carter, and who we interviewed at length over a year ago on Law and Disorder.
Yes, and he also represented one of the five Central Park joggers who was forced into a false confession and spent many, many years in prison, Yusuf Salam. So we've lost a wonderful man. He was 86 years old. He worked 6 days a week up until the end, represented all sorts of people against the powers that be in an extremely effective way. He represented a friend of mine, Albert Victory, who was one of the Attica brothers, actually, who had been framed up on a cop-killing charge and served many, many years in prison, got out on parole, and at that time, Pataki was the governor, and he was running for president, and Pataki didn't want it known that under his watch, a cop killer was let out on parole. So after Albert was let out, they fabricated some stuff and put him back in, which was utterly illegal. And I was in court the day that Myron argued the appeal on that case, and it was quite amazing. He was 85 years old then, kind of bent over, and he was treated with great respect by the panel of federal judges. He explained what happened, and the judges were obviously going to rule in his favor. And then the most amazing thing happened. Two of the attorneys for the state of New York came up and apologized to Myron for having to argue the case. And Myron put on his overcoat with the help of his wife, put on his hat, and went out into the street. And we're still awaiting that decision. I expect it's going to be a favorable one. We'll play more about our interview with Myron.
We will. I think next week we'll run excerpts from that and a little more about his life.
Absolutely.
Smith, I must say that although I'm not as closely following the elections as you are, you were quite prescient last week when you predicted that Ted Cruz would be victorious in Iowa.
It was a choice, I think, that of repugnant people. And I looked at the panel of Republicans that were running there, and I thought, you know, who's worse than the other? And he really came out on top. But I knew that he had been campaigning there. Ted Cruz.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Ted Cruz is a person that no one likes. I read an interview with his college roommate at Princeton. Oh, incidentally, he brags about going to Princeton and calls people that went to places like Brown or the University of Pennsylvania the minor Ivies. And he's a very smart person. He went to Princeton, and then he went to Harvard Law School, and then he got a job clerking for William Rehnquist, who was the chief judge of the United States Supreme Court. And I
How
read interviews with the other clerks for the other judges.
Right.
The thing they remembered most about him was just how extremely enthusiastic he was about the death penalty and how they would get an appeal to the Supreme Court, and they had to write a memo to the judge they worked for, and that would be distributed to all the other clerks who worked for the other judges. He was just savage in his memos. So people didn't really like him for that. But then I read an interview with his college roommate at Princeton, who listed all these things that was obnoxious about him and wound up calling him, don't get me wrong, I think he was a gigantic hole. You can fill in the first word.
Right, bleep.
And so I thought, you know, here's a man who's patted himself against another giant in that respect, Richard Nixon. Even looks a little bit like Richard Nixon. And I thought to myself...
But no matter what we think of Richard Nixon and all that he did wrong, he was actually an intelligent person.
Yeah, just like Ted Cruz.
And had some good foreign policies, right?
Compared to Cruz, who says that we should carpet bomb Syria.
Right.
Yeah. Climate denier Cruz.
Yeah.
Wanted to shut down the government over the issue of funding of Planned Parenthood. Shut down the government.
Yeah.
And this guy's a bad guy, but he has a lot of hardcore support amongst the evangelicals, who, in my opinion, mistakenly call themselves Christians. And that was what gave him his narrow victory.
His advantage.
Over Trump and Rubio. So stay tuned, listeners,
for
my
prognostications. For more Michael Smith commentary.
I'm grateful to have majored in political science.
Today, we take another look at the public water crisis in Flint, Michigan. The legal cases being mounted are being litigated at the intersection of environmental racism and neoliberal capitalist austerity. Flint, a predominantly impoverished African-American city north of Detroit, had an emergency manager imposed on it by Tea Party Governor Rick Snyder. This manager, acting outside of democratic controls, switched the clean water supplied to the city from the Detroit water system to the polluted Flint River, claiming it would save money. Chemicals added to the filthy Flint River water caused lead from the supply lines to leach into the drinking water. This in turn caused lead poisoning to thousands of children in Flint. Lead poisoning, as listeners know, is known to cause irreversible brain damage. Our guest, Bill Goodman, a former president of the National Lawyers Guild, he's also a leading civil rights attorney in Michigan and the former legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Bill, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We want to ask you how this whole mess got started, and is it really about saving money?
Those are two different questions, but let's start with the first one. In 2012, going back to 2010, the state of Michigan has had in one form or another a law called the Emergency Manager Law. This is a law that allows the governor to basically circumvent local government and appoint a local dictator to make all the decisions for a community. And these are decisions which are often life and death decisions. Who's going to be on your police force? Who's going to run your police force? Same for the fire department. And same, it turns out, for the water department. So the emergency manager in Flint came in 2012. Basically, in 2011, Flint had explored a decision to join what's called something called the Karagandhi Water Authority, which would have brought in separate sources of water from Lake Huron, not the Detroit water. But at any rate, there was some back and forth between Detroit and Flint over this. And then, as I said, in 2012 and then again in 2013, the emergency manager said, that's it, we're done with Detroit, we're switching water. This was a way of supposedly saving money. Now, I'll get to your second question in a minute, Heidi, because whether there was really a savings going on here is a very interesting question. But at any rate, Detroit said, okay, your contract will terminate in 2014. And so in 2014, this new source, the KW, Karagandhi Water Authority, they hadn't finished their job yet. And they still haven't finished. It's still be under construction. So Flint decided to just cut off Detroit Water completely, cut off its fiscal ties with Detroit, and pipe into the Flint River, which was a notorious sewer. Basically, it had gotten the deposits from all of the General Motors manufacturing, and it's an enormous manufacturing complex in Flint. All of that was dumped into the Flint River. That aside, then, the water from Flint was pumped into the Flint water system and then to the residents and users throughout the city of Flint. Now, there had been a study in 2011 about whether Flint could use Flint River water, and that study concluded, well, maybe you can. It has some dangerous qualities to it, but one thing you have to do is put in anti-corrosives. This means that as it runs through the old lead service lines throughout the city of Flint, it's not going to leach the lead or the copper or any of the other metals out of the pipes and into the drinking water of the people who were live there. Nonetheless, in 2014, when they switched from the city of Detroit to the Flint River, somebody either forgot to or intentionally failed to add anti-corrosives to the water. And so the water ran through the pipes, this highly corrosive water from the Flint River, without any anti-corrosive agents in it whatsoever, ran through these pipes throughout the city of Flint, especially where there were more lead service lines, and that was the older, poorer, more African-American areas, and leached this lead into people's drinking water. It's their drinking water, it's their cooking water, it's their bathing water, it's their washing water, it's their water, it's their life.
Bill, let me just interrupt you for a second and ask you to explain to our listeners that lead is a neurotoxin. And what does it mean, particularly for children or pregnant women or nursing women, to have this lead in the drinking water?
Especially for children, and especially for children who are, you know, who have not yet been born, who are for pregnant women, this neurotoxin is devastating. It goes directly through the liver, goes into the blood, and then goes into the central nervous system and into the brain. And for young children and infants and babies, it destroys at a massive level brain cells, and kids become lose IQ. They become disturbed and emotionally unstable in other ways. And it's been found that communities where there have been high exposures to lead, those communities have been subjected after the exposures, let's say 10 years, 20 years down the line, to high levels of violence, of criminality, and the whole generation is condemned to both acting out in this way and having itself acted out upon. So that's one of the implications of lead poisoning.
So are you saying that children, a generation of children have been poisoned?
No doubt. That's, in fact, what has been concluded by a doctor at the Hurley Hospital, Dr. Mona Hanna-Tisha, who has concluded that a whole generation of children in Flint has been lead poisoned. Yep.
And how many people are we talking about here?
Well, Flint is, you know, under 100,000, so you're talking about tens of thousands of kids probably.
Whoa.
Yep. Yep, it's bad. Now, Heidi's second question was money really the cause of this? Well, the emergency manager said we'll save money by getting out of Detroit. Detroit Water Department, which wanted to keep Flint as a customer, has done some analysis studies that show that actually it's going to cost Flint more to go to the Karagandhi Water Authority, and certainly more to have gone to the Flint River than it would have been to stay with the city of Detroit. Detroit was trying to say, keep using our water, we'll work with you, we'll cut our rates, we'll give you deals. No, they cut the rates. And that's one of the lies that the governor has made about the whole situation. He said this was why we switched, because Detroit cut us off. No, Flint said we're out of here. That's what happened. And there are a number of reasons that people speculate on this. One is that one of the wealthiest assets that the city of Detroit has is the Detroit Water Department. It's called the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department. So when Detroit went into bankruptcy a couple years ago, this was one of the things that the emergency manager in Detroit had on his agenda, was to raise money for the city of Detroit by privatizing and selling off the Detroit Water Department. It didn't quite happen that way, although it got regionalized. And so in order to make Detroit Water Department more sellable in the sense of less attractive financially, the city of Detroit, in order to give, in other words, give city or the emergency manager justification for selling off the water department, they lost Flint, which is their biggest customer, if not one of their biggest customers. So that's one area of speculation. Another area of speculation is this Karagandhi Water Authority, which they were talking about creating out of Lake Huron to service Flint and that area of the Michigan Thumb. That would have produced huge amounts of water, which would then have been available to oil and gas interests for purposes of fracking. And that's another area of speculation as to why this happened in the way in which it did. Yep.
Yeah, because that water is used to pump underground.
Wow.
To frack.
Yep.
Which causes a number of other problems, as you know. I wanted to ask you about what the emergency manager knew and when he knew it. Because when Dr. Mona revealed, she's the Flint doctor, and she revealed that the water was poisoned with lead.
Right.
They made fun of her. They told her she was faking her statistics.
Right.
But is it true that when they were calling her a liar, that they knew she wasn't?
Well, it's not the emergency manager. At this point, we're now talking about the state of Michigan, the Department of Environmental Quality, and the Department of Human Services. They knew damn well that she was right on, spot on. In fact, the Michigan Department of Human Services did a study that showed that very shortly after the switch, in April and May of 2014, and they routinely study blood lead levels in kids, they showed that there was a spike in blood lead levels amongst children who lived in Flint that coincided precisely with the change in water. So the fact that the governor, the governor's cohorts, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, these people were, as you say, making fun of, they were certainly, I think, attacking Dr. Hanna-Tisha, and they were ignoring her warnings for a little while. They couldn't ignore them for long because their own statistics gave lie to that. But that's just evidence of how they wanted to deny what was going on and keep it, conceal it from the people of Flint that this is dangerous. So, yeah.
Bill, before I ask you about the lawsuit that you've instituted, I wanted to ask you about an observation that a reporter who was hired by the Michigan American Civil Liberties Union, Kurt Guyette, who you might know.
I do know Kurt.
And Kurt said, what we are seeing here is really about the imposition of austerity. This is what austerity looks like. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, yeah, this is, I think that's right. You talk about choices and you talk about impacts, right? The choices are such that is, who is this going to affect? How is it going to affect them? What will the impact be? The choice was emergency managers. We're going to save money in the city of Flint. We're going to count beans. The impact was that, in this case, that it damaged the health of an entire population of a mid-sized American city, and that it did so in a way that was racially discriminatory and certainly class-based, and it picked a poor, predominantly African-American city to do this. So that was the impact. Yeah, I agree with Kurt.
So, Bill, we understand that a couple of class action lawsuits have been filed, mm-hmm. and you filed one of them.
We actually filed three of them.
It's three.
Three separate ones mm-hmm. for sort of technical legal reasons. Yes, we have. The principal lawsuit is a what's called a 1983, a civil rights action in federal court, and that is against a number of public officials, against the city of Flint, against the emergency managers, against officials of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and Michigan Department of Human Services, excuse me. And that's for violating people's constitutional rights, primarily the right to due process. And so that's in federal court. Now, you cannot sue a state in the United States for damages in federal court. That's because of the 11th Amendment, which has been interpreted in that way. So we also sued the state of Michigan in the only court in which you can sue the state of Michigan for damages, and that is the Michigan Court of Claims. So that's another lawsuit against the state of Michigan itself. And then there are common law actions, that is, actions under state common law, Michigan law, against these same public officials, which we brought separately in state court, in Genesee County Circuit Court. And those were basically described as gross negligence claims and claims brought under the Michigan Constitution as well. So we separated them out in three different parcels here.
And Bill, as I understand it, you allege that the state's Department of Health and Human Services had the reports indicating the dramatic increase in blood levels in some of the Flint children of the lead, and that they sat on it for 10 months. I'm curious if...
Undeniable they had them, by the way.
Right,
beyond
undeniable.
Beyond allegation, we've got their documents on it. Yep.
Wow. If they had done something, say, after 2 months, that would have been... gone a long way toward preventing the harm that these children, or if they had stopped earlier.
Yes, it would have gone a long way to certainly in terms of preventing some of the aggravation of the harm that these kids sustained. I mean, yes, you know, any lead is bad for a kid. Any lead sustained for a month is very bad. But then if you compound it month after month after month for approximately 20 months, you really are dooming children to a lot of problems in the future.
But what kind of relief are you asking for in your lawsuit?
We're asking for prospective relief. Primarily, we're asking that the state of Michigan now pull out all of the lead pipes, lead service lines that are in people's homes, and replace it with non-metallic pipes, with plastic pipes. That there be future medical monitoring of children, future all sorts of things that the state may eventually go along with or agree to anyway. Counseling, educational services, pre-K educational services. All of those kinds of things are needed at this point to protect this particular population. Then we're also asking for damages from the state of Michigan for the way in which they have damaged and injured people's lives, and in some cases, killed them, because there's a series of Legionnaires' disease deaths that are attributable to the Flint River.
Bill, this sounds like a hugely expensive proposition, all this remediation. Do you anticipate local authorities saying they don't have the resources to do this, and then would the federal government... Is part of this the federal claims? Would there be emergency money?
Well, the governor has asked the federal government to come in, and I think that the president has agreed that there is some emergency money available for Flint by way of remediating some of the infrastructure there. But that's money, I think, that was already targeted for Michigan anyway. I guess the answer is yes, we're looking for, I would be thrilled and delighted if the federal government could come in and play that kind of role, you bet. But beyond that, the state of Michigan does have money. It had a $500 million surplus this year. And it can, there is money there for the state to come in and provide some real help.
Oh.
You know, it's just really unbelievable. You know, they have a lot of money for when they need it, or say they need it, say for a war in Afghanistan or drones in Pakistan or whatever. But when it comes to this, they don't seem to be doing much or much very quickly. I wanted to ask you about not just the money damages part of it, though, but about is there possibly any kind of criminal proceeding here? Mm-hmm. You know, your ex-mayor of Detroit, Kwame Kilpatrick, stole some money, and he's sitting in prison now for, I think, 28 years. And here you have a whole generation of children poisoned. Why isn't there contemplation of criminal action?
Well, I don't know that there is not. The Attorney General of the state of Michigan, who is how can you describe him? He's a right-wing Republican.
That's descriptive enough.
has undertaken a criminal investigation, has appointed some people to work on that issue for him and undertake the investigation. I guess they'll have subpoena power. And there may be some crimes for which people can be indicted or charged. There is also a federal investigation going on. The Department of Justice is undertaking that. That's a little trickier. I think federal criminal jurisdiction is somewhat more limited, but maybe that'll result in something. I certainly think the Department of Justice is probably a bit more unconflicted and unbiased than the Michigan Attorney General, but it's possible is the answer to your question, Michael. I frankly would be highly surprised to see any criminal indictments coming out of this.
If you were the Attorney General, Bill, in either the state of Michigan or federal Attorney General, what crimes would you charge these people with?
Well, I would consider charging them with violation of the criminal provisions of the Civil Rights Act of 1871. As I said, in our civil case, we've alleged constitutional violations, when people intentionally violate the civil rights of others, there are criminal penalties that go with it. So that would be a starting point. There may be as well some violations here of mail fraud kinds of things, various kinds of dishonesty that have gone on and worked their way through U.S. mail or something like that. That might be some possibilities, but I'm not a criminal prosecutor or even a criminal defense lawyer much, so it's hard for me to comment on some of that. But, yeah.
Bill, what's happening with Darnell Early?
Well, Early was the person who made the decision. We're cutting off Detroit Water today. We're switching the Flint today. The Detroit Water Department has written to me saying, do we want a better deal? I said, no, we're going with Flint River. Basically, you know, hell with you. And that was his decision. And he was the emergency manager at that time in Flint. I don't know a lot about Mr. Early. I mean, I have not paid a lot of attention to his background, particularly other than that he was an emergency manager for Flint. And after he left, resigned from Flint, somebody decided it would be wise to make him the emergency manager of the Detroit Public School System, which he has been until today, and he resigned as of today. Now, the Detroit Public Schools are in complete, total turmoil. Mm. The teachers cannot work under totally oppressive working conditions, all sorts of vermin and unclean conditions and overwhelming conditions in terms of just teaching children. The children can't learn. Children are not attending school. The teachers have been engaging in a sort of work stoppage over the past period of time, and much of this is attributable to Mr. Early's administration of the Detroit Public Schools. So he leaves wreckage wherever he goes, it appears.
What scandalous circumstances for the children all around.
You could make some observations, if you might, Bill, on the fact that, with one exception, I believe, all the cities in Detroit that have been put under the undemocratic grip of these emergency managers have been cities that are predominantly African-American.
Right. You mean all the cities in Michigan? Yes. Every one of them, with the exception of a little town downriver from Detroit called Ecorse, and that was under an emergency manager briefly. But every one, and there have been, you've got Detroit, you've got Flint, you've got Pontiac, you've got Saginaw, you've got Benton Harbor. All of these are communities which have been, and others, that have been under emergency managers. I think Inkster, too. And they are all predominantly African-American cities. In fact, at one time or another, virtually 52% of the African-American population of the state of Michigan has been under the rule of emergency managers, and 2% of the Caucasian population of the state has been under emergency managers. So that'll give you a feeling for it.
Stunning.
Well,
stunning.
The intersection of racism and neoliberal capitalism.
That's right.
Bill,
exactly.
Right.
We're running out of our allotted time, but we don't want to let you go without asking you to tell us what's going to happen in the near future with your lawsuits.
Well, the state of Michigan is filing a motion to dismiss in our federal case, and probably in the others as well, but we know they're doing it in the federal case. They just got another 30 days to file those papers. They're probably going to say that what they did, as we have alleged it, does not violate a clearly established constitutional right. So that's where I would expect. It's called a qualified immunity motion, and it will be in the form of a motion to dismiss. That's the most immediate thing I see happening. And I think it's somewhat ironic that you have the governor of the state of Michigan apologizing, expressing sadness, almost being in tears about the situation, saying he will do whatever it takes to help, and then filing a motion to dismiss the case, saying you have no case.
Right.
Is there a way that our listeners can keep in touch with this or reach out and
yes,
give you some support?
Yes, we have a website for our case, which is called flintwaterclassaction.com.
flintwaterclassaction.com.
Yep.
Great.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Attorney Bill Goodman, for being on Law and Disorder. When there's a significant development, we hope you'll come back on and explain to our listeners what's going on over in Michigan. And we really applaud your great legal work here.
Thanks a lot. I always enjoy Law and Disorder, both listening and participating when I can.
Thanks, Bill. Take care.
Take it easy, Bill.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. We'll be right back.
We speak today with Bernardine Dorn in Chicago about the late attorney Michael Kennedy. Kennedy died 2 weeks ago in New York City from cancer at the age of 78. He was one of the great civil rights and criminal defense lawyers of his generation. Kennedy graduated from law school in California in the 60s and began his career representing Cesar Chavez and the migrant farm workers in California. He also represented Black Panther leader Huey Newton and SDS leaders Rennie Davis and Bernardine Dorn and Native American protesters at Wounded Knee, South Dakota. He later moved to New York and became staff counsel for the National Emergency Civil Liberties Committee, where he represented opponents of the war in Vietnam and supporters of the Irish freedom struggle, among many, many others. Bernardine Dorn was a leader of SDS and a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild, where she served as student organizer in the late 60s. Until recently, she taught law at Northwestern University Law School, supporting justice for juveniles.
Bernardine Dorn, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We were all greatly saddened at the passing of Michael Kennedy, and you knew him personally. Can you tell us a bit about how you got to know him?
Yes, I've been thinking a great deal about it, of course, because Michael's been part of my life for the last 45 years. We met in 1967. I came the week after I graduated from law school from Chicago to New York. And he moved from the West Coast to New York to go to work with the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee. And Mike Tiger, who also spoke at his memorial, came east that same time to begin work with military resistance to the Vietnam War. And I came to work for the National Lawyers Guild, which was had become quite small through the 50s and the early 60s, but still was a beacon of activism and involvement in the Southern Civil Rights Movement, but had never had law school chapters, and my job was to organize law school chapters across the country, National Lawyers Guild chapters. So we all were kind of gathering in New York City at that moment. I remember Ken Cloak, who became the director of the National Lawyers Guild, and me meeting with the Michaels, we called them, Kennedy and Tiger, and kind of dividing up some of the legal work, the anti-war legal work, and military resistance legal work. At the Lawyers Guild, we took on mass arrests, demonstration arrests, and draft resistance of all sorts across the country, providing lawyers, defense, activism, and recruitment of law students to the work. And the Michaels focused on military resistance during that period of time. So that's how I met him. But, you know, it was such a extraordinary, well, maybe it wasn't extraordinary. Maybe it was an ordinary historical moment. The Black Freedom Movement, a civil rights movement of the South, had come north and west. It was the year 1967 of the founding of the Black Panther Party. There were massive demonstrations, for example, in the fall of that year at the Pentagon with a large number of arrests. There was organizing going on at colleges, but also at community colleges and high schools against the war. And draft resistance was both community-based and campus-based at that time. And there were coffee houses outside of military bases. There was the founding of the Young Lords in New York and Chicago and the Puerto Rican movement, the kind of escalation of the work in the Southwest of Latinos around La Raza and Chicano organizing. It was when the Native American movement occupied Alcatraz and the women's liberation movement was born, both through organizations but also through grassroots meetings and conversations. So you think just about that year of 1967, and it's astonishing. It's as if all hell were breaking loose at one moment.
I know, and Michael was involved in a lot of these activities. What was he like?
dashing Irish, filled with humor and stories and blarney and excess. He was, you know, in 1969, he did the Los Siete trial in San Francisco. He was chief counsel in this trial.
Remind our listeners what that was all about.
Right. It was a trial in which seven Mexican-American young people were charged with killing a police officer in San Francisco. So they became known as Los Siete. And Michael was lead counsel on their defense, and they were acquitted. So it was, you know, not the only, not the first, and certainly not the last of the big trials, but it was a unique one and a very front page one. And, you know, it was, I was not there. I never saw it. I can't say I saw it. But by the time I knew him and he had gone back to do this, you know, his reputation was established.
Yeah, well, then he, of course, represented Huey Newton, the Black Panther Party.
That's correct.
He was at Wounded Knee in South
That's
Dakota.
Right.
I mean, his representation is really kind of a representation of the movement and activity in that period of time.
Yes, it certainly is, and it was. And he always mixed, you know, his practice of representing really people whose names would not be recognized with these big kind of splashy, aggressive, repressive trials, and also with you know, work with other lawyers, work with younger lawyers, and work with law students. So I think he had a huge impact from the very beginning. But it was a generation rising up. You know, it was the beginning of the National Conference of Black Lawyers, you know, it everything was changing. Everything seemed to be changing. And the continuing escalation of the war in Vietnam underlay the tremendous struggles that were going on across the country and across different racial and ethnic groups across the country.
Which brings me to this question, Bernardine. You went from being a close friend of Michael's to being a client of Michael's. Can you tell us what he was able to do for you?
Yes. Well, I was a client of his in a literal, dramatic way twice. And, you know, he was not only a completely innovative and, how can I say it, strategic thinker about how to do legal defense, in a way outrageous strategic thinker about it, but he also, I would say, held on to his clients as lifelong friends. And so I felt, once I had worked with him and then become a client of his, that, you know, he was always there for me. I think a lot of the sorrow and the kind of outpouring of love for him since the moment of his death comes from the fact that, you know, people stayed his client and comrade and went to him for advice, not just about the law, but about life and ethical choices and difficult turning points in their life. So Michael first represented me in 1980, so we're leaping ahead quite a while, when I was subpoenaed to a federal grand jury in New York that was investigating the Brinks robbery and killing. So I knew Michael as, you know, as a close friend and colleague through the 11 years that I was underground, but I'm not going to talk too much about that. However, when I returned to public life, Michael represented me, so I turned myself in Chicago in 1980, facing minor demonstration charges because all of the federal conspiracy charges against me had been dropped over the decade that I had been underground. And Michael helped me walk through that, which was a strange and surreal transition for me, as you can imagine. It was the day after. It was December 4th, so it was the anniversary of the assassination of Fred Hampton when I turned myself in. And it was that day rather than the day before, because Richard Daley had just become the state's attorney of Illinois, and he wanted a day where he had all the headlines to himself. And so Michael walked me through that strange process of turning myself in. So Michael helped me turn myself in there. A year later, I was subpoenaed to a federal grand jury in New York City and asked to appear and give fingerprints for this grand jury investigating the Brinks robbery. I had was not involved in the Brinks robbery. I had nothing to do with it. I had my problems with it, but I felt adamant about not cooperating with the federal grand juries that are really fishing expeditions and prosecutors' wet dreams, if you will, where they alone decide who gets charged with what and why. So I resisted the grand jury. Michael advised me against doing that. I had three tiny children at home, and it was, you know, we were living in fifth floor walk-up. I was just back in public life for a year. But I did go to jail, and he gave me this wonderful advice. He always had a kind of a very succinct way of giving advice. So when I insisted that I was going to go to jail, and he said, what you have to do is make yourself very small, like you're going through the eye of a needle. And after it's over, you can come back to your family and to the revolution. So it was just something for me to hold on to during a pretty horrible 8 months of being incarcerated for something I wasn't involved with, but I felt they had no right to coerce my testimony. So those two things happened pretty quickly, turning myself in and then his representation of me through the grand jury. You know, while I was in jail, he did the incredible, was the lead counsel on the incredible trial in Brooklyn, federal court against the IRA supporters in the United States.
That's the Irish Republican Army.
That's the Irish Republican Army.
Yeah.
And so he was successful in convincing everyone that the CIA was involved?
That's right. Between he and his wife, Eleonora, and an incredible team of lawyers who represented these five federal defendants with conspiracy to run guns to the provisional Irish Republican Army. And the guns, by the way, were big guns. They were, which they had in the courtroom the whole time, a 20-millimeter cannon, a flamethrower, 47 machine guns, 11 automatic rifles. But they, you know, Michael managed to get justice, total acquittal, from the jury in a way that was astonishing again.
Yeah, well, he was just amazing. He had a dog named Not Guilty.
Yes. No wonder one of his beloved dogs was named Not Guilty.
We're running out of our allotted time, Bernardine Dorn, but before we say goodbye to you, let me ask you if you have any last thoughts that you want to share with our listeners.
You know, I think that Michael was fearless. He was a courageous wordsmith and fighter. He was willing to risk contempt by going up against a judge or prosecutors because he was scornful of the structures that were rigged against his clients. And I think that he kept his clients as friends and comrades, whether it was the Brotherhood of Eternal Love or the Mitchell brothers or the Black Panthers or Rennie Davis, on and on and on, for a lifetime. He just heard, in fact, his widow, Eleonora, heard from one of Los Siete just yesterday, who had just heard the news of Michael's death. That's a lawyer plus. That's a lawyer plus a mensch. That's a lawyer plus an activist.
Well said.
Yes.
Bernardine Dorn, thank you so much for being with us on Law and Disorder, and we look forward to talking to you in the future.
I love Law and Disorder. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bernardine.
You take it easy. Bye-bye. Okay.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Circles spinning faster and getting larger all the time. A whirlpool spell disaster for all the people who don't rhyme. Him who don't fit through the needle's eye. Him who just don't understand. Understand. Understand, understand. A brand new sense of freedom. A brand new sense of time. You may go and stand alone now. And leave the hate and fear behind. The millions spent for killing, seems the whole world must be dying. All the children who go hungry, how much food we could be buying. Him who don't fit through the needle's eye. Him who just don't understand. Understand. Sense of time.
simply push their lives aside. They seem to carry all their feelings, crushed and crumpled.